It's 1989, a decade after the fall of Pol Pot, I'm taking you back to it, and his brutal regime, which slaughtered 2 million Cambodians in the killing fields. Tens of thousands of people who suffered forced evacuation at the hands of the Khmer Rouge are still living in refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodian border, and they survive on subsistence rations in squalid conditions caught in the crossfire of battle. Joan Healy, a Catholic nun from Melbourne, was one of many foreign aid workers who travelled to Cambodia in response to the humanitarian crisis at that time. And she was obviously suddenly, traumatically transported way beyond her own comfort zone. But it's almost 30 years on now. Conditions there are mercifully not quite so acute. But it's given her time to reflect on the impact of such high drama on her life and those around her, which she tries to assemble in her book that's just out, Writing for Ruxmi. It's a powerful eyewitness account of war, refugee life, and ultimately the survival of the human spirit. And I want to welcome Joan to the program. Hello there.
Oh, hello, Geraldine. Happy to talk with you.
And Joan, I say try to assemble because it is an extremely moving account of life amongst the refugees in Site 2. It's this vast camp that sprawled across the Thai-Cambodian border. But I almost get the impression from you, and I just really want to hear from your own lips, it engulfed you, this process, trying to set it down so that you were faithful to them and yourself. It was an extraordinary effort.
It was an extraordinary effort. It took some years, I think, Geraldine. It was sparked by a young man, a young Cambodian man who'd finished his first degree in Cambodia and was working in villages, and he knew that I was there when he was born in the refugee camp, but he has mercifully really no memory of that. And he was saying, oh well, he really understands his father, but the real question was he had to understand his father a heap better, because he knew that whatever his father was now is formed by all that his father had been through. So I promised him I would tell him as much as I could, and I promised myself I would absolutely not rely on memory. So I went carefully through old journals that I just failed to burn in the meantime, and friends sent me back letters. So anything I wrote when it happened went into the book. Anything else didn't.
And, right, okay, which is interesting in a way, because does that mean a sort of wise reflection where you fiddle, as it were, with some of the specific memories as a more mature woman? You have put that in too, haven't you?
I've added my own reflection since, of course. For the facts, I didn't really realise I was writing history, and it really is classified as history. So it's history on the ground. And I was remarkably close to a lot of events that have happened, not just in the camp, but in the whole 28 years of time.
And you had what I find interesting, apart from some of the stories, some of which are just too hard to read them. I have to tell you, they really are. But it's just you had a home in two places, really. And as you said, you were a couple of years over 50, now you're nudging 80.
I've nudged it. I've nudged it. A little bit past.
So when you reflect, just before we get into some of the details, when you reflect on yourself, how much do you think it altered the course of events that you think panned out before you at the age of 50?
Oh, it totally changed my life. There's no doubt about that. Changed the way I saw the world. It changed the way I saw my faith. It changed the way I reacted with people, changed my ability to sit on the ground and really listen and not assume that I know.
How did it change your faith?
Oh, Geraldine, you had to struggle with saying, I go along with Mary MacKillop, there where you are, you will find God. And it was finding God and God's spirit in extraordinary places. It was It was the understanding that people can come through huge suffering and come out as finer persons than you could ever imagine. And for me, I could only think of that as grace.
Well, it sort of does make you think, I suppose, about the fact that we all live in only portions of what we're capable of living in safe lives.
That's a great way to say it. Like, people were stretched to their absolute limit. Like, when Rex May was a babe in his mother's womb, his father was going on a half ration where they were both starving, so that this little child and his mother could be safe through the pregnancy. I mean, how far can you stretch? And this is a man who had already been blinded by starvation. Night sight is one of the first things to go, and his sight was back again, but he knew what hunger was.
And you just to quote, he obviously was a very wise man, this Maysnee. And he remembers and quotes words of advice his father had given him before dying as a prisoner of the Khmer Rouge: be a healer, son. When this is over, people will need healers.
This has been the central theme of Nee's life ever since, I think. I'm sure it has been manifest in different ways, but this was the father that Rex May was trying to understand. But so, I don't just have that family. There are six different families in the book.
Yeah, tell us about him, though. Tell us about Maysnee, then.
All right. Well, he was born not too far from the Vietnam border, within Cambodia, where the Ho Chi Minh Trail went through. So as a small child, he knew what it was like for his village to be shelled. The family evacuated, as he should have been doing his high school, and he hawked ice around the streets of Phnom Penh to pay for further education, and reached year 12 when the Khmer Rouge came in. Families were separated. Young adolescents like this were put into youth working camps, and he was in one of those. He had to plant rice, dig canals that actually went uphill, you know, hold back his comment, hold back this uselessness of his young life, and just keep surviving. He said, you work, and then you are waiting to be driven to more work, or you're waiting to be taken out to slaughter. And he said, just like an animal, really. And he came through that.
Well, he's a very intelligent man. He studied every course, you know, lots of Western medical specialist courses. He knows about Western treatment for tropical diseases. He can do basic surgery, can't he?
All of these things happened. It was an amazing refugee camp, you know, nearly 200,000 people, and it had lasted so long that specialists, really good doctors from around the world, would come in and do a summer course in a bamboo theatre. And Nee learned to do battleground surgery and all of those things out of that. But he knew it was more than that. In the end, he said, no, it's healing of spirit. What can happen to the spirit of our people after the trauma?
And what's happened to him now?
Well, what's happened to him now? He has continued. He got a doctorate in Australia very fast and went straight back on the ground the very first day he landed back. He's worked at village level all the time, and because of that, because his roots are deep in the villages and he's extremely well known, he is a threat to the Prime Minister, who is clinging to power after more than 30 years in power. He's acting as if he knows the writing could be on the wall with the next general election next year, the local elections this year. So Nee
had... This is Hun Sen, isn't it?
That's Hun Sen, yes. I met him long ago. I know where he comes from. He was a Khmer Rouge fighter. He said to me in a small group, we were waiting together for a lecture, you know, if I didn't do bloodshed, the bloodshed would be worse.
Well, I mean, I met people like that in Cambodia and I sort of learned to pull back from some of my easy judgments too, you know, that they were all Pol Pot.
Exactly.
The complexity of it is staggering. And what you do say in this is that you've decided, it's a very eloquent, that to record this, to chart it, to tell the history. But of course, as you know, when you're there, the young ones don't want to know the history.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. The young ones have, say, now into their late 20s, are starting to realise that whatever they're seeing now is built on what came before. I mean, the young ones, we call the young ones of under about 30, are a vast proportion of the population now, of course. So it is quite important that the history is there. But the sensitive ones, Geraldine, sense that there is something in their family. If it's not going to come out to this generation, the next generation will be asking for it.
Well, one hopes so, because then, you know, presumably, you know, those who remember don't repeat the problems. But I find it staggering, and I didn't entirely blame them, because the history was so horrible. That you'd want to move beyond it. I just must ask you this. So you've got 200,000 Cambodians living in these amazing conditions, spare rations. They'd been through the trauma of war. They'd watched truly dreadful things. So there's an amazing amount of distress and high levels of mental illness among the refugees. Tell us, if you would, about the Centre for the Healing of Heart and Spirit set up in the camp. And, you know, when you reflect on it, did it do good?
It did a huge amount of good, Geraldine. And it was extraordinary, really, because it was not set up by an international NGO. And it was not set up by the UN. It was set up firstly by a woman who's also in the book, that she knew that postpartum distress was almost like an epidemic. And she's saying, how is it? And what do we do in Cambodia? And maybe we should do massage. Maybe we should do traditional healing. Now, Ni, who was trained as a medic, took it further and said, we need to combine our traditional healing with our Western knowledge of medicine. But it is the heart and spirit of people who need to be healed. And that's the story he has carried into the villages. So village people have learned to think. He has become more of a threat because he is so well known, and people who think are not well controlled by a dictator. And at this very crucial time, there's been an attempt to silence anybody who's working like that.
Joan, this is just a tiny snapshot of your book, and I'm afraid we have to leave it there. The clock is ticking on us, so thank you very much indeed, and congratulations for assembling all of this.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
Joan Healy, and her book is Writing for Raksmey, Raksmey. It's a Monash University publication.